Wildside Besties and Baddies. I'm Bailey.
And I'm Chelsea, and we're here to walk you through the wild sides.
From homicides to hosticides and everything in between.
We're so glad you're here, so buckle up and enjoy the ride.
Tell you what I want, what I really, really want. So tell me what you want, what you really, really want.
I wanna really, really, really want, as you could say.
If you wanna be our listener,
you gotta leave us reviews. Make it last forever. Friendship never ends.
Yeah, so if you guys could, again, thank you to everybody who's left us reviews. If you're tuning and listening, please go and leave us a review. We would really, 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 really appreciate it.
Yeah, I know. It's really, really frustrating. It's not frustrating. We hate being that person. We hate being those people where it's like, please leave us reviews. It's just...
it's the nature of it. It's the nature of it.
It really is. So.
Mm-hmm. But on a upside, you guys, I got in touch with this really cool gentleman. And I think... so he reached out to Carl Drew. And Carl Drew said yes to an interview. So we might be able to interview Carl Drew from the Massachusetts State Prison.
I think that's so cool.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's really cool. Yeah, you know, Bailey and I were actually talking this morning on the... this whole podcasting thing has really... it's really evolved for us in ways that we really didn't understand how it would evolve. But we... the more we learn about this and the more we dive into true crime and crime in general, we really feel like changes have to be made, and you know, things like wrongful convictions need to not happen, and we need to care about that stuff. And so we hope that you guys are finding that as inspiring as we are to make a difference and to make a change and to do whatever we can. And we felt like reaching out to Carl Drew, especially if we feel strongly about a wrongful conviction, is one way that we could, again, try to change things for the better, bring more awareness, bring more information to you guys. So we hope that you guys are here for that. And we just didn't know how passionate we would get over that initial thought of like, oh, we should cover true crime stuff.
Mm-hmm. I also reached out to a guy who has spent much of his career derobing KKK members.
Really?
Yeah. So we got a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah.
All right. So today, you guys, it's going to fall in line with a wild side episode because this shit is crazy.
I'm ready for it. I am here for it.
So something really interesting about this case, kind of a fun fact, is it takes place in my... where I lived for a long period of time. And I had heard about these murders, but I didn't really dive into it when I lived there. But it's really crazy because as I was researching this episode, I was like, oh, yeah, I know where that road is. And I know what that house looks like. And I know what this looks like because it's from that area.
Down the Savannah area?
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Yeah, so it's going to be kind of messy, but it's definitely not going to be like the Fall River Cult murders messy. You're not going to need red string and tacks.
Oh, gosh. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, man. That was so... like, it was so fun, but at the same time, it was like all those memes with... was it Charlie Day from Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it just exactly. Was like, now what? Now say that again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so without further ado, you guys, let's jump in. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. So Effingham County, Georgia, sits on Georgia's eastern border and is located about 30 miles northwest of Savannah.
Mm-hmm.
This case takes place in 2008. So just remember that timeline.
2008. Okay.
So in 2008, nestled within its bounds, lived the Height family, who were very well known, very well-liked natives of Effingham County.
Mm-hmm.
The Height's family patriarch was 59-year-old Philip Height, who was a successful real estate developer. He was actively involved with his church, and he headed the family's cattle farm.
Okay.
Philip retired as a technical sergeant after 20 years of service in the Georgia Air National Guard. And Philip and his son, Chris, raised polled Hereford cattle on the Height family farm. He was a member of the American Hereford Association, the Georgia Hereford Association, and the Georgia Cattlemen's Association. So they were in it to win it when it came to like breeding cattle and having like a cattle farm.
Right.
Philip was married to his wife, Linda Height, and they had been happily married for 41 years.
Okay.
Philip and Linda had three sons. Philip, who was the oldest, but he goes by Craig. Christopher was the middle, and Carrie was the baby. So you have Craig, Chris, and Carrie.
I mean, it sounds like a good old-fashioned Southern family. They probably had their names monogrammed on their backpacks and their sweatshirts.
Probably, yeah. And Craig was the eldest of the three boys. And by 2008, Craig had two children. He was unfortunately divorced from his ex-wife. And he was unfortunately on disability due to a really gnarly back injury that he had gotten.
I feel you, Craig.
I couldn't find a whole lot of information about the middle son, Christopher, but Christopher was the middle son. And then you had 32-year-old Carrie as the baby.
I mean, don't you feel like that's pretty typical? Like, if you're not going to find information, it's going to be on the middle child. They're going to be
literally, my brain was like, I'm not even going to touch this therapist middle child thing. Right?
It's a middle child of you, Christopher.
Yeah. And so Carrie, the baby, he graduated from Effingham County High School in 1994. And just a year later, in May of 95, he married his high school sweetheart, Robin. And over the next 15 years, they had three children. So by 2008, they had a 10-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 3-year-old.
Okay.
Carrie had followed in his father's footsteps and had a very successful career in commercial and residential development. Chris and Craig were kind of more the outdoorsmen, hunting, that kind of thing. But Carrie, again, who was the baby, he decided to go a little bit more of the business route like his dad.
Okay.
Carrie enjoyed hunting with his brothers, tending to horses, and boating as a family. Now, what's really interesting that might play into the dynamics of this case is there were reports when I was researching this that Carrie was Philip's favorite son since they shared many of the same interests and passions. But by all reports, the Height family was a normal, very well-respected family that was close-knit and they worked very hard. Unfortunately, all of that changed in August of 2008.
Who do you think is the favorite daughter between you and me?
I don't think there are favorites. I think mom and dad hate us equally at given times and then love us equally at given times. It's like mom always says, I'm not prejudiced because I hate everybody equally.
Don't worry, girls. I hate you both equally. Oh, good answer. I agree.
So the night of August 25th, 2008, this is the start of this heartbreaking, tragic, crazy pretzel twist of a case. Right?
I like twitzel.
Twitzels. So the night of August 25th, 2008, Linda and Philip Height were asleep in their home along with their youngest son, Carrie, who was staying the night with them.
Mm-hmm.
Though it was a small town where everyone leaves their doors unlocked, all the doors in the Heights home were locked and secured. The only access into the home was the carport door using a spare key. And this spare key was kept in a small storage room that was off of the carport, and it rested on top of the AC unit. Early in the morning hours, unbeknownst to the three Height family members sleeping peacefully, an intruder made a quick entrance into the home. The intruder silently navigated his way through the home, making the first stop at the bedroom where Carrie was sleeping.
Oh.
The same bedroom that he slept in growing up as a boy. Just a moment later, the house violently rang with the sound of a shotgun blast that pierced the silence. Carrie Height had been shot point blank range in the face with a shotgun while he slept.
Ew. Oh, gosh.
It was a shot close enough that the styrofoam from the wadding in the shell was embedded in his left eye.
Oh, gosh. Oh. Mm-mm.
Seconds later, the intruder moves to the master bedroom, finding Philip Height in his bed, but stirring from the sound of the blast. Seeing a large figure pointing a shotgun at him, Philip instinctively held up the sheet from his bed, forming a shield, but it was no use. He was shot in the face with the same shotgun that just killed his youngest son.
Oh.
Linda, who had gotten up to go to the bathroom after hearing two loud blasts, came back from the bathroom just in time to witness the fatal shot to her husband. The third and final shot from the shotgun rang out as it was aimed directly in Linda's face. The intruder takes time to stop and pick up three double-aught Winchester buckshot shells from the 12-gauge shotgun and then began dousing the house in gasoline. What the intruder did not expect was that Linda Height had survived being shot in the face with a shotgun.
No. I think we all need to remind our listeners about how we feel about stubbing our pinky toe. Yeah. How in the world do you survive a shotgun blast to the face?
So she had turned her head at the very last second, and although the spray still made contact with her face, she had moved just enough to avoid a direct impact, and so it went through her left cheek and ended up hitting her right shoulder.
What? Oh, that gives me chills.
According to an article by Deanne Kamenecki, after an unknown amount of time, Linda Height awoke from the blackout to the sight of her teeth on the floor. And she began to pray, making her way to the bedroom phone and finding it dead because the phone lines had been cut. She got herself to the kitchen, got to her pocketbook, reached in her pocketbook, found her cell phone, and called 911. Help, please, was all Linda struggled to say at the beginning. The dispatcher asked what's wrong, and Linda said, gun and shot. And due to, again, having been shot in the face, it took Linda nearly 6 minutes to share her address with 911 operators.
Oh, my goodness.
After making the call, she sat down, found some clothing, and just held it against her face and her neck. When hearing Linda making the 911 call, the intruder decided to flee and silently slipped out in the dead of night.
The intruder was still there when Linda made the call?
Because this intruder was dousing the house in gasoline.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So when they heard her making the call, that's when they left.
Which, that's kind of strange to me because it seems like they obviously had malicious intent. I'm kind of wondering why they didn't go ahead and just set it on fire. You know, like it. I mean, if they're there to finish the job and they don't, this is wild.
When the police,
like, why leave? Why even leave a witness?
I don't know. And maybe they assumed that she would succumb to her injuries.
True.
So when police arrived, the intruder had fled and was nowhere in sight. Investigators were also met with a really grisly sight. Both Philip and Carrie were dead in their bed, and Linda was bleeding severely, propped up against a wall.
Mm-mm.
She was rushed to the hospital, where she would eventually stabilize, and detectives soon began to comb through the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
They noticed that there was a pane of that carport door window that had been smashed, but mm-hmm. oddly enough, in the doorknob on the outside of the door was the spare key left in the lock.
Mm-hmm.
Why would an intruder use a spare key to get into the house and break a window for entry into the house? But that wasn't the only thing that was not adding up to investigators. They noticed that there were puddles of gasoline on the floor. Clothes were strewn about, which gave the initial appearance that the home was ransacked in an apparent robbery.
And a burglary, right?
But nothing appeared to have been stolen. There was no missing cash. In fact, there was some cash that was on a table in open sight, but there was no jewelry or electronics missing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have two violent murders, three intended, of two of Effingham's prominent family members.
Mm-hmm.
The news of their deaths absolutely rocked the entire county.
Yeah.
who on earth would want these people dead? Effingham's rumor mill exploded. Could this have been a random burglary gone wrong? Was there a killer running on the streets?
Yes.
Was it a bad business deal that went down?
Maybe.
But very quickly, within the first 3 days after the murders, Effingham's sheriff, Jimmy McDuffie, let the public know that they had no reason to be afraid. In other words, the Heights were targeted.
That is the most Southern name I think I've ever heard. Jimmy McDuffie. Jim McDuff. That's great. That's a great Southern name.
Mm-hmm. So Linda, as I had mentioned before, was in the hospital and was not much help to investigators initially. When she had made the 911 call, she was unaware of the extent of the tragedy. She learned from law enforcement in the hospital that Philip and Carrie had been killed.
Oh my goodness. That poor woman.
Her memories over the next 4 weeks would be blurred due to a combination of trauma and her injuries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, regarding the investigation into the Height family murders, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation took the lead at the request of Jimmy McDuffie because he personally knew Philip Height very well. He knew the family very, very well,
huh,
and feared that there would be a conflict of interest in the case.
Ooh, that's smart. That's real smart.
And I said, good job there.
Yeah,
right?
Real smart.
The sheriff's office and the GBI investigators, they worked around the clock in the first days with long days for months thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
Since Philip was a prominent and successful real estate developer and had made a good, comfortable living for himself, investigators moved their attention initially to his real estate business partners.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps money, and not like tabletop money, but money on a much larger scale may have been the motive for such a horrific double, almost triple homicide.
Sure. Yeah.
So naturally, police began questioning everyone who was close to Philip, Linda, and Carrie. Family members, friends, colleagues, etc.
Yeah, you start at the inner circle and move your way out, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. It didn't take long to rule out colleagues of the Height family. As I mentioned before, they were well-liked, well-respected, and there didn't appear to be anyone close to them that would have had the motive to kill Philip, Linda, and Carrie Height.
Mm-hmm.
So investigators continued their investigation, interviewing family members of the Heights. The innermost circle, as you said, would include the other children and siblings, Craig and Chris.
Mm-hmm.
However, early on into the investigation, even before police officers determined that the intruder had used a shotgun, Craig, the oldest son, had voluntarily shared with investigators that his shotgun, his boots, and gas can that he had stored in a shed at the back of his parents' property had been stolen.
Okay.
What an odd thing to focus on after learning of your father and brother's death and the attempted murder of your mother, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Investigators thought this too, so naturally, they began to dig into Craig Height. What they found was that Craig had been living in one of the family's cabins on a hunting club near Oliver. Remember, he was divorced, so his ex-wife and the two children lived together in the house. He lived in this cabin.
Mm-hmm.
And they discovered that this house was being paid for by Philip. So his dad was paying the mortgage on this house.
Oh, okay.
He owed child support, so he was on back pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
He did not have the financial means like his father and younger brother, Carrie.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to this, investigators uncovered information that roughly a week before the murders, Craig had consulted with a realtor named Christy Campo, and he had consulted with her about purchasing some property for himself.
Okay.
And so Christy, who was very, very familiar with the Height family,
right,
asked if she should give them a call, wondering why they weren't handling this process because they literally were real estate developers, right?
Right. And I'm sure she is kind of like, also, if that is a business deal, she probably is like, I want to make sure I'm not going to step on any toes.
Right.
You know, for
that's, exactly yeah, what she said.
Right.
And then Craig told her, nah, we don't need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
When Christy asked Craig, like, hey, how are you going to finance this like $400,000 investment? Craig told her that he planned to sell a large tract of timberland and pay off a mortgage on another home to get the money to buy the land, adding that he would know more in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So what was even more damning for investigators is that they soon uncovered that Craig was one of only a few people who knew about the spare key to the home of his parents that was hidden there in the carport.
Mm-hmm.
According to an article by Jill Setterstrom, when investigators were interviewing Craig about his alibi the night of the murders, he claimed that he had been watching hunting and fishing shows in his cabin, which was about half an hour away from his parents' house from the murder scene.
Mm-hmm.
GBI Special Agent John Barry searched Craig's cabin and found no sign of a 12-gauge shotgun, but he did find shotgun shells in Craig's truck.
Mm-hmm.
Craig was an avid hunter, and the shotgun shells that this GBI agent found were 3-inch magnum shells that were assumed to be like the ones that were used in the murder of his father and brother.
Okay.
Okay.
But they weren't, because the other shells were Winchesters, right? Or the gun was a Winchester.
Well, it's the, you can use, from my understanding, all of my hunters, please be nice to me, but you can use, like, there are different guns that can take different shotgun shells as long as it's the same type and the same size. You get what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
They found out that he also owned a Remington Model 870 shotgun, which is a gun that would have fired those rounds. However, that weapon was missing and it was never recovered.
Ooh, convenient.
On top of that, 4 days after the murders, Craig was seen with 3 bruises on his upper arms, arguably consistent with him having fired shots from a shotgun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is a good kick on those things.
Mm-hmm. So investigators begin to hone in on Craig as the primary suspect at this point. Fair?
Fair.
But,
oh no,
the further investigators began to dig into Craig Height in their investigation, they uncovered something startling that would send yet another shockwave through the community. Come to find out, Craig was having an affair with, any guesses?
Carrie's wife, his sister-in-law.
Carrie's wife, Robin.
Yeah. Oh, I'm good. Oh, I'm good.
So his sister-in-law, Robin, who is married to his youngest brother, Carrie.
Mm-hmm.
When asked about this relationship initially, Craig totally denied it and insisted that there had been nothing romantic going on between him and Robin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely not. They just sex each other. They just send each other nudes and meet up for two-hour-long lunches at hotel rooms.
Mm-hmm. Just 2 days after the murder of Philip and Carrie... Again, according to an article by Jill Sinderstrom, during one taped interview with investigators, Craig reported, "I know that it looks bad, but I'm going to tell you something. I couldn't do that to my brother." Apparently, earlier that year, so the murders happened in late August of 2008, earlier in that year, which was also around the time that the recession happened.
Yeah, the housing crash of 2008.
Yeah. Philip and Carrie had to work really hard and they were really struggling because, you know, their livelihood was at stake because of this recession.
Right. Hopefully all of you guys remember it, but it was a big deal. Like, it was a really big deal. A lot of people lost kind of like everything. I remember there were news articles about people in Florida that were like trying to just almost give their house away. You know, like, I just need to get out from under this stuff. So it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm. And so apparently earlier that year, so this is the year of the recession, Robin would go on to say that Carrie's demands at work began to grow and it made her feel lonely.
Oh, babe. Why don't you spend time with me? I know that our entire livelihood is like crashing, but I need you to come home and snuggle with me.
So what did she do? She turned to her brother-in-law for support.
Because he's not working very much. He's in a cabin. And he has lots of free time.
The affair began at the beginning of spring that year in 2008 when Robin told Craig she had feelings for him one night after a family dinner at a local restaurant.
No, ma'am. That's bad etiquette. You are Southern. You have been raised better. That is bad etiquette. Bless your heart.
And wouldn't you know, Craig felt the same way.
Craig?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the next day after their, you know, confession, the two were intimate for the first time in the living room of Philip and Linda Height's home while Philip and Linda were asleep in their rooms.
No, that's gross.
Go to your cabin. Go outside.
Go into the car like normal horny teenagers, even though you're not a horny teenager. You're a married grown person with kids. But whatever. What do I know?
So Carrie actually had learned of Robin and Craig's affair around May of 2008.
Oh.
But Carrie was absolutely determined to save his marriage.
He sounds like a stand-up dude.
He is a totally stand-up dude. He sought counseling for him and Robin's marriage, but despite this, Robin and Craig's relationship progressed. It was reported that Carrie was totally opposed to divorce, but Robin was, quote, confused and did not want to end things with her brother-in-law turned lover.
She kind of wanted to have her cake and eat it too, maybe?
Sounds, I mean, don't most people?
I agree. I mean, touche.
So soon, Linda and Philip would come to learn of this devastating love triangle. So Papa Philip and Mama Linda.
Mama Linda, here they come.
And so Papa Philip was really angry about this, and he forbade the two to continue with the affair. Is that how you say it?
Yes, it is. But can you imagine that conversation? Like, I need you to sit down. I forbid you from bumping uglies with each other. My goodness, yeah. Y'all are in-laws.
Yeah. I mean, how awkward is that? Like, one was pretty much your daughter for like 15 years.
Right, with like three kids from your other son. Like, can you even?
Yeah.
Oh, can you even imagine?
And so Papa Philip was so mad that he even threatened to write Craig totally out of his will if he didn't get it together.
Oh.
Philip reminded Robin of all the things that Carrie had provided for her in their marriage, pointing out that Craig would never be able to do the same. She would never be able to keep her lifestyle she was accustomed to that she had been provided by Carrie and his hard work.
Oh, I am like embarrassed by proxy right now. Like, I feel like I should apologize. Like, you're so right. I'm so sorry. Like, oh,
yeah. Oh.
Can you imagine?
So the tension between members of the Height family continued to escalate. I mean, right.
Right. Yeah.
In August of 2008, in one argument on a day shortly before the murders, Philip had again confronted Robin and Craig about the affair and even tried to prevent Robin from leaving her and Carrie's house by taking her car keys. So this man was just like, no.
You were
like,
grounded.
What are you guys? Yes. Like,
you
what are
you grounded, doing? Young lady, to your room.
And so afterwards, Robin called Craig, told him about this interaction.
Oh, Papa feels so mean to me, Craig. He won't let me phone you.
And this is also another sad thing, is even in another confrontation at a different restaurant, Carrie told his brother to stay away from his wife. Isn't this the saddest thing?
I don't know. Like, at what point do you just say, like, you know what? You guys deserve each other. Cut them both out. Let them live in some cabin somewhere and live off the land with no
There are so many strings attached in so many different ways. You could never just, like, totally cut them out. You know what I mean?
No, I know.
So on August 23rd, 2008, the Friday before the murders, Robin and Craig had spent the night together at his hunting cabin in Oliver. How romantic.
Mm-mm.
That visit, I love this next paragraph so much. That visit ended Saturday morning when a couple spotted a low-flying helicopter circling over the cabin.
Did Papa Phil send out a helicopter to spy on them?
What Robin had guessed and turned out to be true is that Papa Philip and Carrie had arranged for a friend to try to photograph Craig, Robin, and their vehicles from the helicopter.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Oh, bless their hearts.
So the next day, August 24th, which was now a day before the murders, Robin asked Carrie about the helicopter, and Carrie responded with, "I've got friends in high places," and pointed to the sky. And so, come to find out, Ellis Wood, who was a business associate of Philip and Carrie's, and he was a close friend, would later go on to testify that he flew the helicopter over the cabin taking photos. He had been provided the coordinates by Carrier Philip, as well as the description of the vehicles to look for.
Mm-hmm.
He told the court that this had been an effort to obtain proof of their affair, which when Carrie was admitting this to Robin, this started a really heated discussion.
But I just want to point out the audacity of this lady, Robin, going to her husband, but not her lover. Like, those are two completely different people, right? And just being like, husband, who I am not intimate with anymore, apparently, did you send a helicopter to spy on me and your brother getting it on in his cabin? Because that's not cool. I don't appreciate that. Like, how do you fit that much audacity in your Gucci bag?
Dude. And Carrie had apparently put a tracker on her vehicle, right?
I mean,
of course.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I mean, I'm sorry. Yes.
And all reports were just that, like, Carrie loved his wife. Like, he loved her. He was devastated by this whole thing. And so they have this heated discussion about, did you or did you not send this helicopter to spy on us?
Mm-hmm.
And so Carrie got so mad at this argument, that's when he left to go stay at his parents' house.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, this argument was the day before the murders.
Yeah.
Robin called Craig not long after Carrie left and told him what happened. Craig was upset, and he told Robin that if Philip and Carrie weren't careful, he would play, quote, old school on them.
Oh. Okay.
It seems to appear that due to his injury, Craig was lacking the financial stability as the rest of his family, and investigators believe that this was a clear motive for him killing his parents.
Yeah.
However, the bruises, the affair, the lies, the missing items, that was all circumstantial, and investigators wanted a stronger case. So the GBI just kept watching Craig and Robin until hopefully they got enough to arrest somebody.
Yeah.
So law enforcement is keeping tabs on Robin and Craig. And 4 months after the murders, Craig moves in with his brother's widow, Robin, and their three kids into her home.
Oh, gosh. No.
Sheriff Jimmy Duffy was quoted as saying, I think most of the community thought it was like a slap in the face about Craig moving in with Robin.
Yeah, I don't even have a snarky comment for that. Like, that's not cool.
Carrie and Craig's mother, Linda, had stated, it didn't do anything for Craig. His appearance of innocence for him to be staying there, right? So she was like, this is not looking good.
Right.
In the same article by CBS News, Robin was quoted as saying, it was not smart. It was definitely not smart. And my family was telling me, you know, do you know how this looks? I mean, and I was like, I don't care what people think. I believe that he's innocent. So this arguably was the nail in the coffin for Craig Height.
Mm-hmm.
Investigators now believe that they had their motive. Craig not only just wanted his brother's wife, but his brother's life, and had killed his brother to get it.
Mm-hmm.
According to the assistant district attorney, Michael Muldrew, speaking of Craig, he is living in his dead brother's house, sleeping in his dead brother's bed next to his dead brother's wife. He is taking his dead brother's children to school, and he is driving his dead brother's truck. He has become, for all practical purposes, Carrie Height.
And I always think, like, those poor kids, like, can you imagine those conversations?
Yeah.
Like, here's your uncle father. You know what I mean? Like, uncle daddy. That's awful.
And to push this even further, 9 months after the brutal Height family murders, there was a third shockwave. Craig and Robin were going to get married.
Oh, I was going to say that Robin was going to have a baby.
Close. They were going to get married.
Okay.
They had plans to marry, take the kids out of Effingham County, and potentially move to South Carolina. Apparently, this was too much for the community. Sheriff Jimmy McDuffie said he was asked, why aren't y'all putting him in jail? He said that he even had one lady call him and tell him that he needed to go to the governor and make the governor make the GBI make an arrest.
Yeah.
So people are calling him up being like, Jimmy. Yeah. What is this wildness that's happening? They're wilding out.
Yeah.
barrel.
So Craig Height, the self-described black sheep of the Height family, who was divorced, owed child support, was unemployed, living off of disability checks, definitely fit the bill for being the guy behind the horrific double murder and attempted murder of Linda.
Oh gosh, you know what? That's right. I kind of forget that he was divorced. Did he have a couple of kids with his wife as well? That's right. Okay, no, it's a dumb question. He's back, like he's backlogged, what am I trying to say, on child support.
Yeah. Oh, both of them, the audacity.
So on May 22nd, 2009, 9 months after the murders, Philip Craig Height was arrested for the attack and he was charged with 2 counts of murder in the deaths of his father and brother and aggravated assault for the shooting of his mother.
Okay.
A week later, he was indicted by a grand jury.
Uh-huh.
On December 1st of 2010, the murder trial of Craig Height begins in the Effingham County Courthouse. During the trial, Craig's family, including his brother Chris and his mother Linda, continued to support him and insisted that there was no way he could have ever resorted to murder. Linda had testified that Craig seemed worried about her and was protective of her in the days after the shooting, and she said she had no reason to suspect that he was the person who pulled the trigger. Again, according to Jill Sinderstrom, Robin testified that she had a, quote, very good, prosperous living with Carrie. He was a very good husband. He was the best father, a wonderful father. She would later go on to tell the court that when Carrie found out about the affair, he was very upset, and he said that if I was going to have an affair, he wished it would have been with anybody else except his brother. I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yep. A motion to move, now this is what's interesting, a motion to move the trial out of Effingham County because of the publicity, because this was a huge local case.
Mm-hmm.
It was denied by the judge in the case, Judge F. Gates Peed.
Mm-hmm.
So during this trial, prosecutors reminded the court of Philip's threats to remove Craig from the will, insinuating and saying that this was essentially part of the reason that Craig wanted to murder his father.
Right, yeah, part of the motive.
Right. The prosecutors also told of another interaction that happened just before the murders, which was Craig walked into his parents' home with a gun and confronted Carrie in front of their father. So it was a little hissy fit. There was no raising of the guns from my understanding, but it was just way over the top. Jurors saw photos of damage from the prosecutors that had been caused that day during that scuffle for the firearm. So photo evidence of this kind of fight or tussle between these family members, and jurors were able to see that.
Huh.
Prosecutor Muldrew again argues that Craig wanted Carrie's life, and that was the motive.
I mean, like, literally, like metaphorically and literally at this point. Like, he literally wanted to have his wife be in his house, be in his status, but also have him not there so that he could.
However, Craig Height's lawyer, Dow Bonds, argued that the public perception of Craig was somehow was trying to become his brother, that was completely distorted.
Oh.
He noted that Craig was a very kind, genuine, and polite person. But perhaps the prosecution's strongest point was the physical evidence of the bruises on Craig's arms.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a lot of back and forth on this, okay?
Right.
To the medical examiner, the explanation is obvious. I think they are consistent with someone who has fired a shotgun, which is what Dr. James Downs testified.
Okay.
But Craig sticks to his story that he got the bruises in a bizarre bathroom tumble onto the toilet, this, that, and the other. And D.A. Muldrew mocked it openly in court.
Yeah.
However, Chris Height, the middle brother, shared with CBS, quote, the position of the bruises on Craig's body were actually impossible to make from a shotgun, end quote. Craig and Chris were both very similar and were avid hunters and outdoorsmen, as I had said previously. Chris went on to say that a shotgun would have to be held at a ridiculous angle to get those bruises, and Craig knew better. Meaning, like, nobody in their right mind ever fires a shotgun from where his bruises were on his body.
Okay.
Okay. However, a firearms expert for the prosecution, Ed Myrick, wasn't so sure. He thinks that a shotgun easily could slip, stating, it's going to get more on my arm, which is going to leave more bruising and it's going to hurt more, mm-hmm. is what he explained.
Mm-hmm.
So the prosecution is arguing that these bruises were possible and likely from firing 3 times from a shotgun, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to kind of drive the point home, well, in a different point to for prosecution, defense attorney Muldrew, he said the key to the case against Craig was literally the spare key used in the door.
Right.
He argued that Craig knew where the spare key was and only a few people knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
Prosecutors argued that Craig smashed the pane of glass to fake a burglary when in reality he simply opened the door with a spare key.
Yeah, I mean, it's all tracking.
Mm-hmm. However, again, Craig's attorney, Dow Bonds, made sure to share with the court that what shocked me was just the clear lack of physical evidence linking him to the murders. There's no DNA, there's no fingerprints, there's no eyewitnesses, there are no confessions. Which, he is not wrong.
You're not wrong.
This is all circumstantial.
Yes, it is.
So thus far in the trial against Craig, the only evidence pointing towards him are literally bruises on his arm and the fact that he has knowledge of a spare key.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is so interesting to me because when we were talking with Dr. K, I believe it was about, you know, you have these NCIS type of shows and it's like, oh, and they're dusting your hands for all this residual stuff and you're picking up fingerprints and all this forensic. And I think that's why, and he was like, you know, it's not really like that. Like that, there's a lot of things that the media or entertainment, TV, will show us. And so I think a lot of us are like, well, you could dust his fingers and see if there's like the residual gunpowder on his hands and get fingerprints off of this key. And I just don't really, after, like I said, after we've talked with a couple of people, I think that's more fairy tale, more just drama, TV drama, than it is real life stuff.
Yeah. And I'm going to ask you a question when I finish this next little piece, because I'm going to be interested on your perspective.
Okay.
So again, the spare key and the bruises is the prosecution's perspective, right?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
But even with the support of his surviving family members, a jury would side with the prosecution. And in December of 2010, they convicted Craig of killing his brother and father.
Okay.
In January of 2011, Craig was given 2 life sentences for each death and an additional 85 years for the other crimes, including the aggravated battery for shooting in his mother in the face.
Okay.
Now, something that was way too sticky and long and complex for me to figure out how to plug in, I'm just going to verbalize it. In one of the articles that I read, the jury initially had started to vote. They were like 8-4 in acquittal and not guilty.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some players on the jury that were dead set that Craig was guilty. And after a while, like hours and hours and hours, eventually that's the scale tipped in the other direction. And so 4 thought he was innocent and 8 thought that he was guilty. So ultimately he ended up getting a full conviction for all. There were 11 charges and he got convicted guilty for all 11.
Yeah. So here's the deal. I have served as a member of a jury in a aggravated assault case. And I will tell you from a personal experience, we had a member who pretty much crossed arms and said, I'll sit here for 3 days. I'll sit here for 3 weeks. I don't care. This dude is not going back on our streets. We are going to get maximum penalty, maximum sentence for this dude. And Doug heels in and just pretty much was like, not happening. Like, it has to be a unanimous vote, right? I mean, I guess it can be a hung jury, but for the most part, I feel like, yeah, it can. If you have a strong enough personality who's like, I don't care. You're not going to go back to work. You're not going to see your family. And I'm fine with that because I am not moving. And So I saw in our case it go from a person on the other end saying absolutely not, he was not guilty, to eventually saying, yeah, I can see your point and I kind of want to go home.
Yeah.
Now, granted, she was the only one who thought he was not guilty, and that could be a whole nother story. I mean, the guy really, like, he was guilty, but, you know, from her perspective, she was just like, no, this is not okay, and he's not guilty. But she eventually did, I'm going to say, cave.
She gave in to the more dominant personality on the jury.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And that's what it sounded like. And even the jurors, like, because they interviewed some of the jurors, and some of them were just like, not really sure. Mm-hmm. And I know, and I don't want to beat this horse, because it seems like this is almost like the Fall River murders all over again. Maybe not to that extent.
Mm-hmm.
But how is this beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yeah.
So I looked up the definition. Like, I looked up the definition of reasonable doubt, and it's essentially saying the guideline, the safe kind of guideline, is 95% certainty. They said there should not be an opinion that they are guilty or not. There should be a 95% chance certainty based off of proof and evidence that this person is guilty. That's what a reasonable doubt is. He had 3 bruises on his arm.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying he's not. I'm just being fair and looking at this from a perspective of he had 3 bruises on his arms. Could that be explained in another way? Sure. Could he have fallen? Absolutely. Could he have gone hunting when he was drunk on his property 2 days before? Yeah.
Right.
You know, like, he could have gotten those bruises if he hunts all the time. He could have gotten that from that. He could have gotten in a love squirrel with his brother or Robin, and they could have given them bruises. I don't know.
Yeah. Like, in the case that I was on, we were lucky enough to literally have the entire incident
on video.
So we were able to watch over and over and over exactly, not like, he said, she said, and we're trying to piece this together.
Right.
We literally had video evidence of the entire thing. So fortunately for us, it was a little bit easier to slow a video down, rewatch it, things like that. But yeah, if you're trying to piece this together and all you have are bruises and a spare key, I mean, I don't know.
And this is the thing, right? So homeboy goes to the investigators as, like, right after the murder of his family and says, hey, these things are missing.
Yeah.
Why would you volunteer that? And listen, people do crazy stuff. Criminals do crazy stuff, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, what if there's somebody close to this family who knows that his stuff was kept there?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right. And I mean, it sounded like there's probably a lot of people who are not on Team Craig right now. If this is a close-knit community and you have a scandal like this, as a lot, you know, I hate to say it, but it looks like we're going to be using that Reba song again. That's not that the lights went out in Georgia.
Yeah.
You know?
So I'm going to kind of dive in for this next part that I literally titled Aftermath. Okay. So Craig got convicted, went to prison.
Yep. 2 life sentences plus 85 years for the aggravated assault for his mom, blah, blah, blah.
Yes. So after the trial, Robin did not have the best time. She kind of went from guy to guy. She dated a guy for a while and got caught up in terroristic threats with this guy. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time here, but she was dating this guy named Eugene, called Gene.
Mm-hmm.
His ex-wife had a boyfriend.
Oh.
Right?
Okay.
So her boyfriend's ex-wife had a boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And so Robin essentially calls his ex-wife, her boyfriend's ex-wife, and is like, how many times does my boyfriend call you? And she's like, all the time. And she was like, I don't believe you, sister. So she calls this ex-wife's boyfriend, was like, how often does my boyfriend call his ex-wife? And he was like, all the time.
Oh.
And she was like, I don't believe you. And she started harassing them over the phone. And this boyfriend, this random, you know, not her boyfriend, but the other boyfriend, was just like, oh, are you going to send someone to kill me also?
Oh.
And she came back and said that she would come and kill him herself.
You know, Robin, I don't like saying that people are not very smart, but you're not the brightest crayon in the box right now.
And so the result of this was a restraining order against her and her boyfriend, Gene. Robin was, and also, I wanted to kind of throw this in here because I didn't want to throw it in back then because I wanted
there's a method to my madness.
Right. Yeah.
But back in 2010, when this trial was going on, Robin was arrested for intimidating a witness at the trial, but she was never indicted for it.
This woman is, she is feral. Like, have they checked her for rabies? What is happening?
She also, so again, in this whole aftermath story, she also got arrested for not paying the money owed to her ex-mother-in-law, Miss Mama Linda,
mm-hmm.
for child support for her children, because Linda initially received sole temporary custody of Carrie and Robin's children.
Oh, oh my.
And so Robin was behind on the payment, and so essentially they sent out a warrant for her arrest if she didn't pay it at this time. She didn't pay it at that time, and her attorney was like, the reason she didn't pay it on time was because Craig was being held in Effingham County Jail, and she was too scared to go there to make her payment, which is like literally in a whole ass different part of the jail, right?
What is the like trending saying right now? Are you so effing for real right now?
Yeah. And so Robin would eventually go on to have half custody that she shared with Linda, so her ex-mother-in-law.
Oh, that's awkward.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Robin would go on to remarry a different dude in 2011 and move up to Charleston.
And 2011? Isn't mm-hmm. that when Craig was sentenced?
Mm-hmm.
Like, sister doesn't waste very much time.
Mm-mm.
Do we want to talk about the fact that I couldn't get a prom date? And this woman has had, like, multiple husbands and like boyfriend.
There are more men that's going to come up in this case for her.
Thanks to Betsy. Not a single prom date. Not one. Well, Melanie. Thanks, Mel.
Mel's the best. At this point, I want to bring up the wild part about the shotgun. It was too much to put when we were in the trial. We've got to bring it at this point. So during the trial, prosecutors did not have a shotgun to present to the jury as evidence. Remember, there was no weapon.
It was missing.
All three victims were shot with a 12-gauge buckshot, but the killer did not leave any empty shell casings, as we said.
Right.
Remember that Craig, they found those 3-inch Magnum shells in his truck
right.
when investigators searched, blah, blah, blah. They found that he owned a Remington Model 870 shotgun, a gun that would likely fire those rounds.
Mm-hmm.
But according to an article by Deanne Kamenecki, the tricky thing here is that there is no way to identify any specific shotgun as the murder weapon without shell casings. Because they fire small pellets and don't yield the same telltale markings that allow ballistic experts to match bullets fired, right?
Right. Correct.
And so what's even more is that it's not surprising that both Craig and Carrie, so both the brothers, owned a Remington Model 870 shotgun. And the gun maker calls this model literally the best selling shotgun in the world, with more than 10 million having been produced.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say it's probably the Bluebell homemade ice cream, homemade vanilla ice cream. Like, everybody has it in their freezer.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is the type of town where boys got the little shotgun hangs in the back of their truck. You know what I mean? Like, everybody has a shotgun.
Correct.
So why so much focus on the shotgun? Obviously, because there was no murder weapon, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Craig's shotgun was missing and never recovered. But what's wild, okay, is there was a man by the name of Walter David Dumas, and he testified at the trial that he took a shotgun to the sheriff after he noticed it was the same Remington model that prosecutors suspected to be the murder weapon. So this guy is like, I have this shotgun, and what I'm hearing from trial, it sounds like it's the same type. And because of this next piece that I'm about to say is why he took it to the sheriff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What had happened was that Robin was actually the one who brought this guy, Mr. Dumas. She brought him the gun in pieces and asked if he would reassemble it. Dumas said that he was told the shotgun had been taken apart by Robin's brother, John Henry Rast. So, this guy, who's a family friend of the Heights, the widow, Robin, comes to him and says, hey, my brother disassembled the shotgun. Can you reassemble it?
All right.
So that's weird, right?
Yeah.
Why is this shotgun being disassembled by Robin's brother?
Disassemble it. You can probably reassemble it. I don't think you would disassemble it and then be like, oh, crap, I'm missing my favorite Netflix show. Sorry, I got to run. Here's your disassembled shotgun. Good luck to you.
Yeah.
Whatever.
And so this is where I wanted to bring something really interesting up. Robin's brother, who lived close by at the time of the murders, John, he ended up committing suicide in September of 2010 in her home.
Ew. Oh. Her home?
11 months after the double homicide of Philip and Carrie Height, Robin's brother commits suicide.
Mm-hmm.
His obituary said that he was the owner of All Around Outdoors in Rincon, and he was an avid outdoorsman.
Mm-hmm.
His death naturally prompted a delay in the trial, and Craig's attorney said that if Rast, John Rast, Robin's brother, can be linked to the shotgun, he might be the real killer.
Oh.
He said that's a theory we can't completely exclude.
Okay.
So in 2013, Craig filed for an appeal for a new trial. The basis was around the shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
The shotgun had been owned by Carrie and had not been turned over to the defense. Craig's defense attorney, Mr. Dow Bonds, argued that had this shotgun been turned over prior to the original trial, there likely would have been a drastically different outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He claims that the state, the prosecutors, failed to inform the defense of a shotgun taken by Robin for repair to a Port Wentworth man, as we had talked about during this trial process in the original trial.
Yes. So essentially, would this be considered new evidence in the case?
Yes. That's what he's arguing. Supposedly, testimony in the trial indicated that Robin's brother was out of state when the murders were committed. So we're not really sure.
Uh-huh.
And Dumas, this man who brought this evidence, said he never worked on a 12-gauge shotgun after Robin delivered it, and he took it to the sheriff and realized it could be connected. So that's what prompted him to take it there. Right? Again, according to a different article by Deanne Komanecki, McDuffie told the court that the shotgun was never tested for any evidence because it was never thought to be the murder weapon. The serial number on the gun identified that it was registered to Carrie. So this was Carrie's shotgun. Sheriff McDuffie said that Craig's attorney Bonds and prosecutor Michael Muldrow had been told about this whole shotgun situation from Mr. Dumas during the trial. He said that there are records of the sheriff's office keeping the gun in 2009, and that should have been included in the case file, but it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
The sheriff said he went to the courthouse to tell the prosecutors during the trial that someone had brought this gun back to his office, and so the judge called the attorneys from both sides into a meeting. And supposedly they all agreed that it didn't warrant delaying the trial. But Bonds, Craig's attorney, says he didn't recall any meeting with the judge about a shotgun.
What?
This is crazy, right? Regardless of all of this, like, hey, there's a shotgun. This could have totally changed the direction with the jury and the original trial. I don't have record that you guys essentially... The defense is saying that y'all were keeping evidence from the trial.
Wow. Yeah.
And regardless of this, the same judge, Judge F. Gates Peed, ultimately did not feel that this new evidence of the shotgun would have made any changes to the jury, so the motion for a new trial was denied. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court unanimously upheld this conviction. Now, to end this craziness, I'm going to take a quick pause and go back to the summer of 2008.
Okay.
And literally what I titled this section is Planting Seeds of Doubt.
Okay.
So before the murders, what's interesting is that earlier in the summer of 2008, Papa Philip had also been working on a new will after the scandal had broken.
Mm-hmm.
He was looking to change the part in his will that concerned preserving 300 of acres of family land for the future. And it was reported that Philip had shared with his attorney that he wanted to completely write Craig out of the will.
Mm-hmm.
He eventually changed his mind about that, but he did make it to where Craig's share was reduced from 1/3 to 1/9 in his will.
Okay.
And do you want to guess when the revised will was signed?
Probably the August, like 23rd.
The 22nd.
Yeah.
3 days before the murders.
Yeah.
What's even more, earlier in the summer, as I said, Carrie found out about Robin's affair, and he secretly started divorce proceedings that Robin didn't know about.
Uh-huh.
Part of these proceedings on Carrie's end meant that he was changing the beneficiary on his $3.5 million life insurance policy from Robin to a trust for his three children, but Robin had no idea.
Uh-huh.
She did not find out that she was no longer the beneficiary until after the murders. So, Craig was aware that his father was threatening to write him out of the will. It was no secret, no surprise. Papa Philip threatened it multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, would being written out of a will be enough motive to kill?
Mm.
What about that, along with having an affair with your brother's wife, was the only way for Craig and Robin to move on was to have Carrie, Philip, and Linda out of the picture? And so let me ask you it from this angle. In theory, total theory, Robin may have had no qualms about Carrie murdered because she knew she was going to inherit $3.5 million in life insurance.
Right.
No big deal if Craig doesn't get it because she's going to have enough for the both of them.
Correct.
Right. Do you think, again, just in this theory, that it would have changed her mind about Carrie being a targeted victim had she found out that she wouldn't get any of that money? Just in theory, let's say she was part of this,
mm-hmm.
and she knew that she was changed, there's no point in killing these three family members.
I was going to say.
But for $3.5 million.
Yeah, right.
Why kill three people if you knew you weren't getting any money, like Craig? Why kill three people if you weren't going to get any of that? Unless, right, we knew that my sister-in-law girlfriend is going to get a nice payout from her husband, his policy, right?
Mm-hmm.
The night that Carrie had stayed with his parents, the night him and his father were murdered and his mother was severely injured, was the first night in 13 years he stayed with his parents. He never stayed the night with them.
I was going to say, like, what are the odds that whoever it was that pulled the trigger knew that he was over there,
mm-hmm.
at his parents' house?
And who all knew about the spare key?
I mean,
probably every one of the boys, their spouses.
Yeah. And maybe
the grandchildren.
And maybe not even grandchildren. Like, I mean, that might be it.
Regardless of any of these theories, I just put that in there to just get you to think.
Mm-hmm.
The remaining Height family members are doing what they can to move on and try to find peace in the aftermath of such tragedy and destruction. Linda and Chris Height have been left to pick up the pieces together and come to terms with their life being turned totally upside down.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, Philip and Carrie Height lost their lives likely due to the selfish decisions of those closest to them. And so perhaps this is a cautionary tale of lust and greed that shows how easily lives can be torn apart literally in the blink of an eye.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the really sad, really tragic Height family murders.
You know, it almost makes you wonder, or it makes me wonder, did Robin get to a point where she was like, you know what? I could probably get Craig to fall in love with me. We could have this affair, get him like hook, line, and sinker. And then I could probably convince him to kill Carrie. We would get $3.5 million. Like, I could leave him. Like, I could do whatever I needed to. Like, this might be a Black Widow case. You know what I mean? Like, it could be that she had this all planned out and was just the puppet master thinking that the end game was going to be $3.5 million.
Listen, I totally agree. I think the thing that really, really bothers me, I mean, I think it goes without saying, like, killing somebody else for literally no reason bothers me. But outside of the obvious, what really bothers me, this is like the Mike Williams case.
Mm-hmm.
He's this good old guy,
mm-hmm.
married his high school sweetheart,
yeah,
did really well, provided for him. She ends up marrying his best friend, who's a sex addict, and right. tries to kidnap her at gunpoint.
Right.
And Robin is married to this really great guy who does really well for them and supports them.
Yeah.
And she goes after kind of like his loser brother.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about these women who have this really great life and these great men, and they just, it's like they throw a grenade into the middle of it, like they can't help themselves. And the reports were that these men that Robin started dating afterwards were like, they had charges for like assault and domestic violence, and they just like weren't good guys. Like, what the hell are you doing? What is that?
It's almost like the guy had a Florence Nightingale syndrome. You know, like he saw her as like, oh, she could be, she could change, she could be fixed, she could be a really great,
I guess.
You know what I mean? Like, which is unusual, right? It seems like it's usually the women who go after these, I don't know. This thing is so, it's like an onion. Like, there's so many stinky layers to this. I don't even know. So the end result was, did Craig ever get a new trial?
Mm-mm. The last that I saw, the appeal was denied in 2013.
And he has never confessed. He's still saying that he's innocent.
He has claimed that he's innocent from the first day. But there's also reports that he was caught in a lot of lies. Like whenever he was telling investigators that he would never, you know, have an affair with Robin, she had already confessed to investigators that they were having an affair.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know.
Well, not strange that her brother committed suicide. Was her brother actually the fall guy? You know, was her brother actually the one that pulled the trigger for Robin?
So that was my thought. And I want to be super clear that there's nothing pointing at this from my understanding. I just think it's a little much of a coincidence for her brother to have disassembled the shotgun, and then he ended up killing himself in her house after the murders of the family members. Now, to be fair, could it have been that he was so overwhelmed with the social judgment of this small town and what was going on, and it was too much coupled with mental health issues? Sure. Does it necessarily mean that he had a guilty conscience? No.
Could he have been killed and made it look like it was a suicide?
We could run this hole into the ground, but I personally do not.
I think Robin was a big player.
Robin was a player in it. Whether it was emotionally manipulative, right. psychologically manipulative, you know, whatever the case is, I think that she was a big player in it. So
I don't know. I think Craig did it. I really do. I think Craig did it. And I think it probably, he was Twitter pated by Robin. And I mean, she was a bold chick, you know, like if she could go out and just be like, were you spying on me while I was.
Yeah. And she threw him under the bus in the trial. Like at first she was like, no, like we're gonna get married, we're like, he's innocent. And when the trial came around, she was just like, yeah,
peace, I'll get married to this other dude. I mean, she got married the same year that he was convicted and went to jail. So I don't know.
I think that maybe don't make your partner your beneficiary on your life insurance policy.
What is it? What did Kanye say? Holla, we want prenup. We want prenup.
Yeah. So my heart goes out to the Height family.
Yeah. No family should have to endure that. No community should have to endure that. Because you have to remember, especially when you are part of an intimate community, a smaller community, like it affects the entire community. you know, yeah. And that's just, yeah, just selfish on so many levels.
Yeah, I remember when I lived around there, everybody would bring it up.
Oh, and
right. I wasn't from that area, right? So it wasn't, I was just like, oh, wow, crazy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. People talked about it.
What would people say? What are some things that you've heard while you were living down there about it?
I don't remember. Yeah. This was so long ago.
Yes.
I just remember the concept of it,
right,
and them talking about that it was crazy and that there was this wild affair and,
yeah,
you know, it was a whole family spectacle. So yeah, that's all I remember about it.
Guys, you heard it here first. Get a better hobby.
Get a better hobby.
Get a better hobby.
All right. Well, we appreciate you guys for hanging out with us through this crazy wild ride. And we will catch you
on the flip side.
Bye, guys.
Later, Gators. Hey, Wildside Tribe. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Wildside Podcast.
Make sure to tune in on Wildside Wednesdays. New episodes will drop each Wednesday at 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
We would love to hear from you. So if you have a wild case recommendation, email us at wildsidepodcast@gmail.com. That's wildside with a C. Or share your thoughts in the comments below.
As always, if you haven't heard it today, you're loved, you're worthy, and you're valuable. And we'll catch you on
the flip side.